Chapter 6. Is there a set pattern? Developmental psychology. The most obvious way in which people develop is physical, transforming them from tiny, helpless babies into more or less capable adults. However, development, and especially psychological development, does not end when physical maturity is reached. It continues throughout adulthood. The findings of developmental psychologists reveal what is developmentally typical, and this has many practical uses in advising parents about what to expect at different ages, planning education programs, determining when a child is not developing normally, predicting the effects of early experience on later behavior, and creating appropriate opportunities for older people. Developmental psychology is concerned both with mapping the changes that occur with age and with understanding how those changes take place, the process of development. Two questions are particularly important in looking at processes. First, does development take place in stages, or is the process more continuous than that? And second, is development biologically determined by nature, the genetically programmed process of physical maturation, or influenced by environmental circumstances, by nurture? The concept of stages suggests that everyone passes through the same stages in the same order, reaching the later ones only by going through the earlier. It clearly is necessary to acquire basic before complex skills, to learn to count before learning to add, or to grasp before lifting. And rough stages of development are reflected in the terms baby, child, and adult. But are there also finer stages? If so, how flexible are they? Observation suggests that development is not as fixed as the idea of stages suggests. Most children crawl before they can walk, but some do not. Exceptions to the rule led developmental psychologists to propose that there are critical periods in human development. That is, time periods during which events must occur for development to proceed normally. For example, if a human fetus does not receive the correct hormones before the 7th week, a genetic male may fail to develop male sexual organs until puberty triggers another bout of hormonal activity. There is some evidence that there are also critical, or at least sensitive, periods in psychological development. Case studies suggest that children who have not started to learn language by about the age of 7 find it very difficult to learn later. A case of extreme deprivation, Jeannie. Jeannie came to the attention of the authorities when she was 13. She had been treated extremely harshly by her parents. She spent nearly all the time alone and tightly bound. She was never spoken to and was beaten for making any sound. When she was discovered, Jeannie lacked many basic skills. She could neither chew nor walk upright, was incontinent, and understood little language. Jeannie was given intensive rehabilitation and eventually placed in a foster home. She made amazing progress in developing both physical and social skills. However, although she learned to understand and use basic language, her grammar and pronunciation remained abnormal. Jeannie's case is an extreme example of how environmental circumstances can affect development. The relative importance of genetic and environmental factors, the nature-nurture question, arises in many topics of psychology, but it is of special relevance when thinking about development. Observations of extraordinary similarities between twins reared apart, for example, in their preferences for certain styles of dress or music, suggest that predetermined pathways may not be modifiable during the course of development. However, more thorough work has now convinced most psychologists that components of both nature and nurture are required for healthy development. For example, the potential to learn a spoken language is inborn, or a nature component. But the rate of language learning, the form of the language, accent, vocabulary, and ability to use it to express complex thoughts or feelings is determined by nurture, including cultural influences, such as those affecting the different ways in which men and women use language. What is inborn? As already mentioned in Chapter 3, babies are born predisposed to learn. They are born with useful reflexes, such as sucking and grasping, and babies only a few days old can discriminate voices and prefer looking at faces. At 1 month, babies can discriminate sounds in order to gain a sweet taste. In all species, the young appear to be primed to learn skills that are useful, and human babies may be set up with abilities that encourage caregiving from adults. For example, newborn babies cannot adapt the focus of their eyes as objects move closer and farther away, but focus at approximately the distance at which they are typically held. Similarly, newborn babies' exceptional ability to discriminate speech sounds allows them to recognize and show a preference for their mother's voice by the time they are 3 days old. It is even possible that some learning takes place in the womb. Newborn babies respond differently to their mother's language than to other languages. However, an innate potential or ability may guide and facilitate subsequent learning. The following experiment suggests that babies are born able to organize and interpret the flood of sensory stimuli they experience, as if they were already using some elementary perceptual principles, such as those described in Chapter 2. What do babies know about numbers? Babies 6 to 8 months old were shown a series of pairs of slides, one showing 3 and the other showing 2 objects. At the same time as seeing a pair of slides, the baby heard either 2 or 3 drum beats from a central speaker. The babies tended to look longer at the slide that matched the number of drum beats. So when there were 2 drum beats, the babies spent more time looking at the slide with 2 objects. These results suggest that babies can abstract numerical information sufficiently well to recognize similarity or to match like with like. It is not suggested that they have specific knowledge about numbers, but that they have some innate ability that helps them to learn about them. The child's development. More changes occur in the first few years of life than in any other time period. For example, you grow half your height and learn enough language to communicate basic needs by the age of 2. Although no formal training is required for children to learn basic skills such as walking and talking, there is much variation in the rate at which children learn these skills. Developmental psychologists have tried to find out what factors influence this process. Children who are raised in institutions where they get little attention or few opportunities to play develop at a slower rate than children in more stimulating environments. However, the detrimental effects of understimulation can be remedied by the opportunity to play for as little as 1 hour a day. Observations of children raised in deprived environments suggest that when opportunities for exercise and movement are impoverished, there is some delay in both cognitive and motor development, as if playing helped a child to think. Such findings led developmental psychologists to question whether extra stimulation or training accelerated the development of children who were not deprived. This idea was tested by experiments like this one. One of a pair of identical twins was given a lot of early practice at a particular skill, such as crawling. Later, the other twin was given a brief period of practice, and the performance of both twins was compared. In general, the twins performed about the same if the least practiced one had had even a little practice. For basic motor skills, a little practice later, when the child is physically more mature, can be as good as a lot of practice earlier. Personality and social development. If physical development is governed by experience as well as by the process of physical maturation, is this also true for other aspects of development, such as personality and social development? Babies develop social responses very early indeed. Two-month-old babies of different cultures, and even blind babies, smile at their mothers, an action that is likely to strengthen the mother-child bond. The universality of smiling suggests that maturation is important in determining its onset. By 3 or 4 months, babies recognize and prefer familiar people, but they remain friendly toward strangers until about 8 to 12 months old, when a fear of strangers develops. Both distress on separation and fear of strangers decrease by the age of 2 or 3, when children are more able to take care of some of their own needs. These changes make evolutionary sense. The fear of strangers increases with mobility and then decreases with increasing capability. It has been suggested that the child's bond with its primary caregiver, or the person who does the majority of the caring for the child, is crucial in determining later psychological development. For example, in 1951, John Bowlby maintained that mother love in infancy and childhood is as important for mental health as are vitamins and proteins for physical health. More recently, he has suggested that people with psychiatric disorders tend to show the kind of disturbance in their social relationships that could result from poor bonding in childhood. Developmental psychologists have investigated whether the quality and/or quantity of early relationships does indeed determine later functioning, and what factors influence early relationships. A child's early relationships are often referred to as attachments, that is, relatively enduring emotional ties to a particular person or the attachment figure. Attachment can be measured by how much babies and young children seek to be near the attachment figure and are generally oriented towards them, becoming upset when they leave and happy when they return. Attachments may enable children to feel secure in new settings, so they can explore both physically and psychologically, gradually increasing their independence and detachment from the attachment figure. Attachment normally peaks between 12 and 18 months and gradually declines after that, but its effects may persist. Developmental psychologists have classified the quality of children's attachments by observing their behavior in a structured setting called the strange situation, in which a child and its mother are in a room full of toys. After some time, they are joined by someone who is a stranger to the child. Then the mother leaves and returns a short while later. The child's behavior is observed at all stages through a one-way mirror. The attachments were described in 3 classifications. Those children described as anxious avoidant are largely unaffected by the mother's presence. They pay little attention to her and do not appear distressed by her leaving. Usually, these babies make little effort to contact the mother on her return. Usually, they are not distressed by the stranger's presence. Generally, they treat mother and stranger in a similar manner, that is, are as easily comforted by the stranger as by the mother. Those described as securely attached play happily as long as the mother is present. They are clearly upset when she leaves. They immediately seek and gain comfort from the mother when she returns, then resume play. They are friendly to the strangers when the mother is present, but are distressed in her absence. They are clearly more attached to the mother than to the stranger. Finally, those described as anxious-resistant have difficulty in using the mother as a safe base for exploration. They tend to become upset when she is not at hand, and very upset when she leaves. When she returns, they seem ambivalent towards her. That is, they cry to be picked up, then scream to be put down. They resist the efforts of the stranger to make contact. Although initially it was thought that babies were showing cupboard love, that they became attached to their mothers primarily because they were the main source of food, experiments with monkeys suggest that this is not the case. Infant monkeys were separated from their mothers shortly after birth and were given two substitute mothers. Both substitute mothers were made from wire mesh with wooden heads. One was covered with foam padding and terry cloth, making it more cuddly. The other was bare wire but dispensed milk from a bottle attached to its chest. The monkeys showed much more attachment to the cuddly mother, in spite of the fact that it was the other mother that gave them milk. In humans, it seems that the most important factors influencing attachment are the child's temperament, or its nature, and the attachment figure's responsiveness, or understanding of and sensitivity to the child's needs. The attachment figures of insecurely attached babies tend to respond more on the basis of their own needs than to the baby's signals. For example, playing with the baby when it is convenient for them, rather than when the baby shows signs of wanting to play. This may explain why a child's strongest attachment may not be to the person who does most of the physical caretaking. It seems that the quality of care is more important than the quantity in determining a child's attachments. Effects of early experience. An important enterprise for developmental psychology has been to try to determine whether early experiences, such as poor parenting, affect later development, and if the effects of a deprived early life can be ameliorated. The following experiment investigates the effects of early deprivation. Raising monkeys in total or partial isolation, where they can see but not touch other monkeys, has shown that such conditions lead to highly maladaptive behavior. These monkeys were socially withdrawn and aggressive to their peers. They had difficulty mating and often subsequently became abusive mothers. However, if the monkeys were reintegrated by 3 months, or if they were given even one playmate, they could develop normally. Other experiments involved raising monkeys with abusive mothers, which were cloth monkeys that blasted the infants with cold air. These studies found that the abused baby monkeys showed stronger attachments to their mothers. Although it would be unethical to carry out such experiments with human babies, case studies such as that of Jeannie give some information about the effects of early deprivation. One study which investigated the effects of separating babies from their parents looked at children who had been placed in care by the age of 4 months. It was found that those who had been adopted by the age of 4 years subsequently developed much better than those who had been returned to their natural parents, or those who remained in the institution. This may have been due to the higher social class of the adoptive parents, or because the returned children went back to homes that still had many problems. These results show that the detrimental effects of early separation can be ameliorated, and that attachments formed as late as 4 years old can provide a basis for healthy development. Moreover, the finding that some of the children who remained in the institution were doing better than those returned to their natural parents contradicts Bowlby's view that mother love is always best. In general, studies suggest that infants who are securely attached are better equipped to cope with new experiences and relationships. And research is accumulating to suggest that poor attachment in infancy could be an early precursor on the developmental pathway to later psychopathology. Such research findings can provide a sound scientific grounding for clinical theories and may contribute to the development of better ways of relieving some clinical problems and helping parents to be better caregivers. Moreover, many studies show that the harmful effects of early experiences can be ameliorated, particularly if the child is still young when the conditions are improved. In fact, many researchers have been struck by children's resilience, in that there is a tendency toward normal development under all but the most adverse circumstances. Development over the lifespan. People continue to develop both physically and psychologically throughout their lives. Whilst changes such as puberty are at least partly due to physical maturation, others reflect a substantial degree of environmental influence. For instance, people tend to adopt a more sedentary lifestyle with increasing age, but this may simply be a reaction to environmental changes such as retirement and decreasing social involvement and physical health. In 1968, Erickson proposed a stage theory of lifespan development, which suggests that human development follows a pattern of stages, psychosocial crises, primary activities, significant relationships, and favorable outcomes. In the first year, the psychosocial crisis is trust versus mistrust. The primary activity is consistent, stable care from parents. The significant relationship is the main caregiver, and the favorable outcome is trust and optimism. From ages 2 to 3, the psychosocial crisis is autonomy versus doubt. The primary activity continues to be consistent, stable care from the parents. The significant relationships are parents, and the favorable outcome is a sense of autonomy and self-esteem. From ages 4 to 5, the psychosocial crisis is initiative versus guilt. The primary activity is environmental exploration. The significant relationship is with the basic family. The favorable outcome is self-direction and purpose. From age 6 to puberty, the psychosocial crisis is industry versus inferiority. The primary activity is knowledge acquisition. Significant relationships are with family, neighbors, and school. The favorable outcome is a sense of competence and achievement. In adolescence, the psychosocial crisis is identity versus confusion. The primary activity focuses on coherent vocation and personality. The significant relationships are with peers and in and out groups. And the favorable outcome is integrated self-image. In early adulthood, the psychosocial crisis becomes intimacy versus isolation. The primary activity involves deep and lasting relationships. The significant relationships are with friends and lovers, and in competition and cooperation. The favorable outcome is the ability to experience love and commitment. In middle adulthood, the psychosocial crisis is generativity versus self-absorption. The primary activity is being productive and creative for society. The significant relationships revolve around divided labor and shared household. The favorable outcome is concern for family, society, and future generations. And in late adulthood, the psychosocial crisis is integrity versus despair. The primary activity becomes life review and evaluation. The significant relationships are with mankind and the extended family. And the favorable outcome is a sense of satisfaction and acceptance of death. This theory suggests that there are definite stages, each involving a specific task or psychosocial crisis, that everyone progresses through during a lifetime. For example, the main task of adolescence is seen as being a search for identity. Initially, largely on the basis of observations of adolescents referred for treatment, adolescence was seen as a turbulent period characterized by rebellion and rejection of authority figures. However, studying the general population of adolescents revealed that many do not rebel against authority, but maintain good relationships with parents and teachers throughout. This is one example demonstrating the pitfalls which arise when observations are taken from a small and unrepresentative sample of the larger population. Subsequent studies investigating adolescents from all backgrounds have been more struck by the amount of role transition during this period. During adolescence, many new roles, such as that of worker or boyfriend-girlfriend, and adult-to-adult interaction patterns are acquired. Erickson suggests that the most important task during adolescence is the process of coming to terms with these new roles, finding a single, integrated identity, in spite of having to act differently in many new roles. As each stage lays the foundation for the next one, this coherent sense of identity is thought to lay the foundation for later relationships and productivity in adulthood. Without an integrated identity, Erickson thought that people would experience identity diffusion and would have difficulty forming relationships, planning for the future, and achieving their goals. Without a clear sense of who we are, deciding what we want from the future is difficult. Studies of declining cognitive functioning with increasing age also demonstrate the pitfalls of looking at subsamples of the population. Studies comparing intelligence test scores in groups of older and younger people showed that younger people had higher IQs, suggesting that intelligence declined with age. However, these studies failed to take account of the cohort effect, social determinants of performance on IQ tests, and the fact that intelligence scores of the whole population had increased with better education and nutrition. When intelligence was measured repeatedly in the same people, there was no evidence that it declined with age. Rather, it increased slightly for those who continued to use their minds. Similarly, the supposed deterioration of memory with age does not stand up well to scientific investigation, but suggests that the system responds to the demands you make of it. Comparisons of memory for everyday events show that older people perform slightly better than younger ones, possibly because they are more concerned about their memories and are more attentive and motivated during testing. The myth of declining memory with increasing age appears to be partly due to a self-fulfilling prophecy. Because people expect to become more forgetful, they try less hard and notice forgetting more than remembering. It appears that as long as people continue to keep their minds active, they need not expect a noticeable decline in their mental abilities until very late in life, in the absence of medical conditions such as dementia. Although there is little scientific basis for the myth of declining intellect with age, there are some changes in behavior that are typically associated with aging. For example, in Western societies, older people tend to be much less prominent than other age groups. Disengagement theory proposes that as people age, a biological mechanism is activated and encourages them to gradually withdraw from society, just as an animal creeps away to die once its evolutionary function, ensuring the survival of its offspring, has been fulfilled. However, the analogy is a poor fit, because in humans, this process of disengagement does not tie in with the end of child rearing, nor is it associated with poor physical health. In contrast, activity theory explains the disengagement of older people as a societal process. There are fewer roles for older people to play in society, and retirement may reduce opportunities to play a valuable part in everyday living. Although some people replace their working roles with other valuable activities, others do not and may feel useless or isolated. The effects of changes in activity associated with aging may be exacerbated in Western societies by ageism. Stereotypes of older people are generally negative, that they are less intelligent, sickly, lazy, rigid in their views, and bad-tempered. As with other forms of prejudice, such stereotypes are largely false. For example, it is the exception rather than the rule for older people to become confused. Like other prejudices, ageism can be self-maintaining in that positive contributions made by older people are overlooked while negative factors are remembered. In Chapter 9, you'll hear a fuller description of prejudices and how they can be overcome. We have seen that many biological, social, and environmental factors influence developmental processes. Although there is a rough pattern for development, and self-righting tendencies stimulate constant adaptation, there are also many potential pitfalls. Because development is such a complex process, we should be cautious in interpreting differences between different age groups, as such differences could result from changes over the generations, rather than from aging itself. Nevertheless, developmental psychology can indicate which factors affect development adversely and which do not, in fields as diverse as moral development, language acquisition, and the development of thinking and gender identity. Future challenges for developmental psychologists focus on finding ways of ameliorating the effects of negative early experiences, finding remedies for when development is not proceeding normally, and looking at ways of enhancing adjustment throughout the lifespan.